Okay, everybody, let's get settled again, please. Okay, guys, we're gonna start. So we have two more talks. The first talk is by Marty Fair, who's gonna talk about basically the state of what we know about cutting thermal noise. And then Rana is gonna talk about Voyager, so take it away, Marty. We need somebody, Darrell, can somebody figure out how to get his talk?
I think it's that one.
That's it?
Yep.
That's it, right there. That's it. Good. Good. Thanks.
So the issue with coating noise or with thermal noise is straightforward conceptually. There's KT of energy in every elastic mode of the test mass mirror. The higher the Q of the test mass, the more the displacement is concentrated near the resonant frequency. And for looking out in the tails, as our signal band is, there's an improvement in the spectral density with the Q of the mass. A more careful treatment of a case where the mirror coating dominates the Q of the mass, which is the situation we're in, by Yuri Levin, showed this kind of scaling behavior for the spectral density of displacement noise. The key features for us are primarily this one here. The coating elastic loss is in proportion to that spectral density. The coating thickness as well contributes. A higher index contrast coating with fewer layers is better linearly in that thickness, and it scales inversely with the square of the spot size interrogating the test mass surface. I think a slightly antiquated version of the A-plus design shows what would happen if one improved the elastic dissipation. This factor phi, the ratio of the imaginary to real parts of the Young's modulus, by a factor of 2, that was this line. If you increased it by 4, you would get down to there and start to dip below the quantum noise. So some plausible targets for A plus. Some plausible targets for A plus with respect to our existing coating loss numbers for the titania tantala high index layer and the silica low index layer is to improve this dissipation of the high index layer, which dominates, by a factor of 2 to 4, which means at room temperature you would need to have a number of order 10 to the minus 4, perhaps half that. And importantly, while achieving that reduction of the elastic dissipation, you need to preserve all the other challenging optical properties required of the coatings already in terms of scatter absorption and uniformity over the aperture of the mirror. The timeline over which one hopes to get these, I think we just heard 18 months from Mike. Perhaps budget might push this out 1 to 2 years, but still for a materials discovery program, that's a very aggressive schedule. So what I'm going to talk about is a quick sketch of what we think we know now about empirically and a little bit theoretically about coating noise, in particular the two-level system model that's generally used to describe internal friction in amorphous solids, some theoretical guidance that we're getting from some recent work, molecular dynamics work from Haiping Cheng's group at Florida, a little more theory about some ultra-stable glass concepts that are also recently coming into play in predicting how to reduce the two-level systems responsible for plastic dissipation in these materials, and take a look at some amorphous silicon, which seems to tie up pretty well with that ultra-stable glass theory and is a potential for LIGO Voyager, though perhaps not for A+. And then say some words about structural characterization and some thoughts on strategy going forward. This is a compressed version of a longer talk I gave at GW80W. There's a link here if some of this stuff is too compressed for the present purposes. So this is a reasonably typical plot of the elastic dissipation as a function of temperature. This is in the advanced LIGO titania doped tantalum material. Measured at a few different acoustic frequencies, and it shows a characteristic peak, often known as a relaxation or a Debye peak, at some low temperature, and then decreases towards room temperature. Bulk SiO2, not a thin film, shows some interesting features, in particular this very advantageous one for us, that it has a nice dip in its elastic loss right around room temperature. That's why it makes such a great test mass substrate material, but at low temperatures, it looks like just about every other chalcogenide or silicide or oxide glass you care to look at, they all tend to group into a rather small band of behaviors, which universality we'll come back to a little later on. Oops. Some other features that are observed empirically. Certain dopants, for example, titania and tantala, reduce the loss. These are curves of, again, the loss versus temperature for films with progressively more titania doping. Annealing the films after deposition, again, influences the loss, not always in simple ways. This is pure tantala annealed at progressively higher temperatures. And you can see that when measured at room temperature, the loss improves with annealing. When measured at a lower temperature, the loss could actually be worse after the annealing process. So the dependencies are not necessarily simple. So how can we find better amorphous oxides? One could try a random search through the ternary oxides. That's a few thousand compounds you could come up with, and various doping levels. Thermal processing adds more variables. That's a pretty complicated situation. Art's long, life is short. These kind of Edisonian methods probably don't scale gracefully, especially to the time scales and resources available for an A+ improvement. So that leads us to try to look a little bit more at some theoretical understanding of what's going on. And the next few slides, I'll try to introduce some of those ideas. Generally accepted model for the elastic dissipation in amorphous solids considers a double well potential. You might consider a bond, an atom flopping through a bond, strain bond. That's a bit oversimple, as we'll see, but conceptualize that. So you go from one side of that line to the other. You go from one energy state to another, and elastic energy in the mass can be lost into these double wells. There's in a crystalline material this kind of situation with the regular bonds. Usually these materials are dominated by other mechanisms, but in amorphous materials with a distribution of such, let's call them bond angles for simplicity, this distribution of bond angles produces a distribution of double wells, which can then couple to the elastic field energy. So if you analyze a case where there's a single kind of well with a particular energy barrier between the two wells, the scaling of the internal friction or the Q in such a material shows a couple of features that are important for our purposes. It peaks when the thermal relaxation time from the excited state back to the ground state, which we'll call tau here, it's on the order of 1 over the frequency you care about. So for us, tens of milliseconds or something like that for 100 hertz noise. And because this is a thermally activated temperature, process at the temperatures we care about, that is an exponentially activated relaxation process and so has sort of a barrier height over KT in the exponent. Therefore, a particular tau is worst case for the frequency of interest. That means a particular temperature will be the worst case for a frequency of interest. That's that low temperature peak we saw, for example, in the Tantala data. If you added a second such double well with a different barrier height, say a higher barrier height, then the total contribution of those two would be something a bit more complicated. And in fact, if you sit in this valley between those two collections of wells, you can have some rather complicated behavior. And that's probably what we're seeing in SiO2 at 300 Kelvin, that there is a gap in this, as sketched on that figure. So in real materials, there isn't one or two or three kinds of these double wells. There's some kind of continuous distribution. So you would take that loss expression and you would integrate it over some density of probability density of a certain barrier height and a certain barrier asymmetry to get the total loss observed in that material. These are some numerical calculations, some simulations of what that barrier height and the asymmetry distribution might look like as a function of energy in pure silica, some work done by Haiping Cheng's group. So you'd have to put these guys in here and integrate that expression to evaluate the total loss. Also, work from her group shows that, in fact, it isn't a simple single atom motion of flopping through a bond that matters here. It's actually the coordinated motion of many of these functional units, these polyhedra in the solid. This is an example for Tantala of the configuration of a collection of some dozens of atoms in one side of the potential well and on the other side of the potential well. And here it highlights those atoms that have the greatest motion getting from one side of the well to the other. Similar calculation for titania. So the takeaway point here is that you really have to think of several nanometer sized structures when you want to think about what's contributing to these loss mechanisms. These molecular dynamics calculations that her group has done have actually provided some increasingly strong correlations with experiment. For example, here are her predicted elastic losses as a function of titanium doping. Sorry, these curves are different titanium dopings and titania doped Tantala. This is, again, the usual loss versus temperature set of curves. These are some experimental data taken by the GEO group, Peter Murray, and you can see that the same correlation and same general temperature dependencies are being now observed in this not trivial calculation of this ternary oxide and the actual experimental observations. So these correct trends will already start to suggest to us potentially interesting materials, for example, zirconia doped Tantala, which we'll come back to a little later on. It can be extended, as we'll again say a few words about in a minute, to not just cooling a liquid, which is the simulation she had done now, but rather the actual vapor deposition process, as has started to be done. And this, as we'll see, can lend some very useful guidance towards the more perfect glasses we see. One issue with their work so far is that the agreement at cryogenic temperatures is better than that at higher temperatures, but they are making some modifications recently that seem to be addressing some of those kind of issues. So another theoretical concept that's important here are so-called ultra-stable glasses. Ultra-stable glasses, what do we mean by that term? If you take some energy landscape in the, sorry, it didn't reproduce too well, in some configuration space, and this is a many-atom configuration space projected into one conceptual dimension, there's a rather rugged energy landscape as you modify this configuration. If you take a liquid and you cool it, the nature of this glass transition is that as you cool, you get trapped in some rigid state where the atoms can no longer, oops, what did I just do? You know, I'll take a guess that that's it. That's it. Any guesses?
Remote, sorry.
If you can take it out remotely, you can't put it back, it's non-recyclable.
What? It was after that, right?
Yeah, it's fine, thanks.
Okay.
Sorry. As you cool this, this liquid, depending on how fast you cool, you can interrogate more and more configurations and fall into a lower and lower collection of configuration states. But you probably don't get to this hypothesized so-called ultra-stable or isolated or ideal glass state. The reason that's important to us is that in these rugged landscapes up here, you have more of these double wells, you have more more places to lose elastic energy into the dissipation mechanism. Down here, you're well isolated from nearby wells. The barrier height is very high, and you should see and the density of these kind of states is very low, and you should see lower losses. Unfortunately, if you wanted to cool a liquid and get to this state, it probably takes thousands of years or the age of the universe or something exponentially hard. And so you usually can't get there by cooling a liquid. But what has recently been hypothesized and supported by some experimental work is that if you do vapor deposition, the key point is, as these atoms from the vapor condense onto the surface here, there's a highly mobile liquid layer, pseudo-liquid layer, and so these guys can move around much more, explore much more of this energy landscape than can a particle that's caged by a surrounding solid. So in a liquid where the solid immediately cages all the particles as it gets into one of these trapped states, annealing can help a little bit to walk you down this energy landscape, but it's nothing like what can happen during vapor deposition, because until the next layer buries these highly mobile surface atoms, you don't have this steric constraint that you have once the thing is surrounded by other atoms, caged by other atoms. This paper here by Singh does a nice job simulating this process by modified molecular dynamic type calculations. So elevated deposition temperatures and slow deposition rates both favor this ability of these particles to adjust themselves farther down this energy landscape. Without getting too deep into the weeds here, the upshot of these theoretical calculations is that moderately universally you would expect to need your optimal deposition temperature for the substrate is somewhere around 8/10 of the glass temperature, the temperature where the liquid phase conceptually turns into the amorphous solid phase. And we'll see that this scaling, this hot substrate scaling, actually seems to tie up with an important material for our purposes, amorphous silicon behavior. In fact, that's this slide here, some work by Frances Hellman's group at Berkeley. She deposited amorphous silicon by thermal evaporation in two different methods. One, she deposited at a relatively low substrate temperature here between room temperature and about 300 C, and subsequently annealed the film after it was deposited at a high temperature, 350 degrees C, and she compared that to films deposited at a high temperature and not subsequently annealed. She tried annealing. These films didn't change much with annealing. And you can see that the internal, again, we're seeing loss versus temperature. You can see that the loss on these high temperature deposited films is 1.5 orders of magnitude lower than a film deposited at low temperature and subsequently annealed at temperatures like these deposition temperatures. And these losses here are a few 10 to the minus sixes. They're not the 10 to the minus fours that we're talking about. So another interesting point is that the deposition temperature, where you see this big leap in behavior, is about 75% of the glass temperature for silicon. And so it ties up pretty well with that more or less universal prediction of 0.8 times the glass temperature. Some other measures of the two-level system density in these glasses also showed a similar reduction as was seen in the elastic loss, so tying up this high-temperature deposition in the more perfect glass to a reduction in the two-level system seems to hang together on several fronts. Similar results have been observed in some model systems like low glass temperature organics that are of no use to us but are useful for testing the condensed matter physics concepts in question. And so the takeaway for this seems to be that depositing at about 8/10 of the glass temperature using low deposition rates and possibly other mechanisms for increasing the surface mobility of the ions during deposition, for example, ion beam assist, could all contribute to getting this low two-level system density important for our low-loss considerations. So, ultra-stable glasses for A+. Amorphous silicon has another family of defects, so-called dangling bonds, which have little to do with the elastic dissipation, but unfortunately have pretty strong near-infrared optical absorption. So I don't think it's going to get to the case where we can have a 1 micron mirror based on amorphous silicon, but the cross-section of that absorption drops off steeply at longer waves, so we'll come back to that when we talk about Voyager. But if we don't use amorphous silicon, that doesn't mean you can't get to one of these better glasses. Ideally, we could find an oxide glass, for all we know, tantala, that with suitable deposition temperatures and suitable deposition rates would produce this same result. So, in fact, LIGO Labs has started to engage commercial coating vendors like MLD in retrofitting their IBS systems to do high temperature depositions. Discussions are, or even some work now is underway with some university groups. University of Western Scotland has a heated substrate, low rate ECR sputtering system and has been getting some very interesting results we'll touch on a bit later. Frances Hellman at UC Berkeley has been sharing samples of her silicon work and she's gonna start doing some oxides, we hope in the near future. So some open questions and some key issues for experiment and theory with respect to this stuff. We don't really know the glass temperatures for these non-glass forming materials like tantala, zirconia. You cool one of those from a liquid, you just get a polycrystalline mass. So this is a thermodynamic concept that can exist in principle, but you need a theorist, as was needed for the silicon case, another material that's not a natural glass former, to do some calculations to see are any of these a conveniently low temperature that's compatible with reasonable ion beam sputtering kind of deposition systems. Can one use a dual ion beam system to activate the surface energy? I believe Stuart Reed at UWS is already walking down this path a bit to see what he can do. Another challenge that may occur for these oxide materials, we don't know yet, if it crystallizes before it forms the ultra-stable glass, that's an issue, obviously. We aren't going to get the amorphous film we want. And then we might have to look into things like frustrating the crystallization via suitable dopants or perhaps nanolayers, as again, we'll talk about a little more in a minute. And we truly need the modeling to inform this process, especially if we hope to get anything done in 15 months or 18 months to enable a pathfinder on Mike's optimistic timescale. Okay. So if the high temperature deposition and this more perfect glass scheme doesn't work, what plan B might exist? Well, it's been observed that generally higher annealing temperatures lower the room temperature losses of most of the technological glasses, hafnia, silica, tantala, zirconia. So you might not get to this ultra-stable regime, but you might still lower the defect densities, the two-level system densities that we care about. Typically, the upper temperature you can anneal a film to is limited by the point where it starts to crystallize. And so methods for frustrating the crystallization with a suitable dopant allow higher annealing temperatures and potentially get us to better performing films. The zirconia doped tantala I referenced earlier is one such material. Instead of the normal tantala crystallization temperature of about 600C, this kind of doping pushed it up to about 800C, and Steve Penn, in some preliminary work, just reported that the loss was knocked down below the usual numbers by about a root two. So that's obviously in progress, but it is one possible route. It's probably going to be a more incremental improvement than one could get with the more perfect glass, but it may still be significant. Another method to frustrate crystallization is to do it geometrically, work on so-called nanolayers, where thin layers of a stable glass former like silica are interspersed in the high-index non-glass forming material like titania. Such work, then, if these layers are on the scale of the nuclei that would lead to the crystallization, then compressed crystallization, and annealing of a such a titania silica system was seen to push the crystallization temperature up to 300C, and again see some reasonably low losses. It's not clear if volume or interface scatter in these kind of densely multi-layered systems is going to be an issue for LIGO purposes, but again, it's a promising alternative to the ultra-stable glasses. Oops. So, in addition to simply measuring quantities like the elastic loss, other tools for characterizing the properties of these amorphous films can provide useful empirical information and ways to tie up with the theory, as we'll talk about in a minute. There's a family of structural characterization techniques for measuring short-range order in these amorphous materials, things like TEM, NMR, XFs, Raman scattering. For example, the pair distribution function obtained electron diffraction patterns can be combined with inverse Monte Carlo techniques to get some predicted structures. This work has been going on for a while, some particularly by Ricardo Basiri and some colleagues at GO and at Stanford. Particularly important for our purposes are not the short-range order. As we've now learned, the extended structures that contribute to this elastic loss are not just nearest neighbor kind of issues, but rather nanometer, multi-nanometer scale problems. And so being able to characterize medium-range order on those extended scales is increasingly seen to be important for understanding the materials we're dealing with here. Fluctuation electron microscopy, where the fluctuations in the scattering of a very small size probe can be used for such characterization, as can so-called grazing incidence X-ray pair distribution functions taken at the synchrotron at SLAC. They both can provide such information, and much Ricardo reports some recent work in these areas of medium range order measurements. So last couple of thoughts about this A-plus story. How could one use structural characterization most usefully to improve our coatings? Well, the changes are subtle. I didn't have time to talk about what the theory predicts, but let's just say they're subtle, and it's difficult to unambiguously invert the kind of data that you obtain from these scattering measurements to a structure. So going in the other direction, again, relying on our theorist friends to take their theoretically postulated structures from, say, the molecular dynamics and do a forward calculation for what should the scattering pattern look like, that's a much more fruitful approach, I think, for using these two theoretical and experimental tools to inform one another. And one takeaway message I'd like to leave about this is that experiment and theory are now reaching the stage of maturity they didn't have 5 years ago and are able to usefully interact with one another instead of just being two independent tracks trying to tease some information out of this complex landscape of material physics. Usually I hate these kind of diagrams. When I see them in a proposal, I assume somebody's just pulling the wool over my eyes. I think I'm usually right, but in this case, I don't. So what I'm trying to show here is the kind of interactions that the increasing maturity of the structural characterization, the synthesis techniques, and the simulation techniques are now starting to have some kind of virtuous, well, it's not a circle, but it's a polyhedron or something. And the kind of things I'm talking about are the molecular dynamics should be able to give us guidance on finding low glass temperature materials, advantageous dopants for reducing two-level system densities, for enabling higher annealing temperatures, and describe things like optimum rates of deposition and substrate temperatures if they're extended to that kind of calculation as we saw for the silicon. And simultaneously, the molecular dynamics can help interpret the structural characterization data. And of course, structural characterization data can be used to validate the predictions of the molecular dynamics simulation. And of course, there's other ties here. Look for correlations between the structural characterization motifs and the loss spectra. Again, useful to connect these independent lines of thinking. Of course, there will always be some empirical optimization connecting loss measurements and film deposition experiments. Okay, so let me not read this summary of the A-plus story, but ultra-stable glasses, some experiments are beginning. It's a very promising route. Other experimental approaches to synthesize lower loss coatings, in particular stabilizing higher annealing temperatures, and I'll say a word in a minute about multi-material coatings, seems promising. And atomic structure modeling and atomic structure characterization are reaching the level of maturity where they're actually starting to interact usefully with each other and with the rest of the process. So, as far as Voyager goes, well, everything is different. It's a silicon substrate, it's cryogenic, the wavelengths are longer out in the infrared, and the requirement on the loss is another factor of, say, 5 better than A+, to get to these kind of performance levels. What might one do? Well, one thing one might do is take advantage of those longer wavelengths and use amorphous silicon. The absorption of these dangling bonds drops off rather steeply with wavelength. It's about 10 times smaller at 1.5 microns than at 1. And so some recent work, and the dangling bond density does depend a lot on the synthesis methods used. Some recent work, again, from UWS, with a hot substrate and a low rate ECR deposition system, showed that extrapolating from a single amorphous silicon layer to a quarter wave of silica stack, that you might get to about 20 ppm of absorption on an HR at 1.5 microns. You could further ameliorate this thing with the so-called multi-material coatings that MIT group and Glaswegians came up with, the notion being that you put the low optical loss mediocre elastic material for the first few layers at the top of the stack, put the lousier optical material with good elastic properties for the remainder of the stack where the intensity of the light is lower. So this would be a way to leverage the existing optical performance of the known materials together with these more complicated materials like amorphous silicon to try to get an overall structure that's better, better at both optical and elastic properties. Some work I saw at the optical interference coating meeting last week, again from the UWS group. They've also been doing IBS of amorphous silicon in a hydrogen-containing plasma. This seems, again, to show some promising reduction of this optical absorption and decent long-term stability. Last thought with respect to things besides amorphous materials, amorphous oxides one might use for Voyager. Crystalline coatings get rid of this whole two-level system problem because they're crystalline. They don't have these random structural features. And Garrett Cole and his company, Crystalline Mirror Solutions, have shown very nice properties, very low optical and elastic losses in gallium arsenide, gallium aluminum arsenide, multi-layer mirrors deposited on a gallium arsenide substrate and transferred to a mirror substrate. An alternative that doesn't require such a transfer scheme is to epitaxially grow gallium phosphide aluminum gallium phosphide mirrors directly on a silicon mirror substrate. We did some very preliminary work on this and saw that the elastic losses were low. The optical losses, it's a bit of another story. We stopped that project, but Stuart Reed at UWS again has put together a phosphide MBE system and is starting to look at this kind of direct deposited system as well as these AlGaAs mirrors. So I think the takeaway message for these crystalline coatings is the things we don't know that they're good enough at yet. They tend to have isolated macroscopic so-called oval defects that can scatter light. While the scatter loss on low, small areas, hundreds of micron areas, is fine, we don't know what it is measured over large areas where you interrogate these rare but strong scatterers, but those kind of measurements are now getting launched. I think more fundamental is the issue that nobody in the optoelectronics industry, who are the people who drive the development of these MBE systems, cares to have nanometer scale uniformity on multi-micron thick coatings over 34 centimeters. So any such tool would be developed solely for the purposes of LIGO, and that would be a big project. There are some more specific things with respect to these materials, but let's not worry about those. So summarizing what I think we know, for A plus at 1 micron at room temperature with 2019 or maybe 2020 is a target for starting some, who knows, 2017 if we go with Mike's estimate. Ultra-stable oxide glasses produced on hot substrates with perhaps with an ion beam assist and low deposition rates, a promising approach. Stabilized annealing at high temperatures by suppressed crystallization with dopants or with nanolayers, and the use of atomic structure modeling and experiment to inform these studies is sort of the path I can see going forward. For Voyager, maybe the ultra-stable glasses, maybe multi-material coatings with oxides and amorphous silicon will play out, maybe crystalline coatings, but there's a big technology barrier there, and I don't know about Explorer.
Time for one or two questions. First, Ricardo, and then Stephen.
That was a nice, very nice view of what it is. There is one information that we did not touch. Lamar has found these hundreds of thousands of tiny scatterers in the LIGO mirrors. That is information that it may be connected with one of the things that, that you are.
Crystallization during annealing?
Yeah, whatever it could be, it is also maybe likely the locus of some mechanical losses. Coincidences are rare in nature. So, but it could be, certainly there is a optical scattering, but it may even be mechanical losses there. You want to comment about this? Because I can
see. We should have fewer of them.
Huh?
We should make fewer of them.
You see, I mean, what I was thinking is that it may end up being a good diagnostic tool to add to your to the panel today.
Certainly, any macroscopic defect with surface.
Marty, I think in order for the TNT post area, you need to speak.
Oh. The question was the observation of many tiny scattering sites in some coatings suggests there may be an additional mechanism on top of the ones I discussed contributing to the elastic loss. And I think anything that creates an inhomogeneity in the material and certainly the interfaces between a crystal and an amorphous material could so contribute. And beyond that, if they're already causing optical scattering problems, there's already a compelling reason to figure out a process that doesn't produce them. So I guess the short version would be, as we do things, especially those that might promote nanocrystal formation, like these higher temperature annealings, we should be aware of not, of being careful about creating such other problems.
Thank you.
Just a comment on the Algas size constraint that you mentioned. It is true that current optics are rather big, but partly that's because the loss is so big. And if the improvement in loss angle is good enough, we might actually relax that size requirement.
Yeah,
there might be sort of a middle path to get to.
Even over a 15 centimeter, say, mirror, nobody in the optoelectronics industry cares whether it's a half nanometer thicker or thinner after a few microns. It's just way off the scale of the thickness tolerances they control to. And so that would be, as I say, a whole new tool development that that industry doesn't care for. It would have to be driven by LIGO money.
Agreed, but at least the wafers are available.
Okay. Ray, one quick question.
I'm just thinking, I mean, if you're talking about nanometer scales for the correlation, and I imagine it's hard to, in a coding house to get the whole thing to go up to 300 to 400 UC. That sounds like a big deal. That's the way you're heading. Has anybody looked at just painting the systems that go out at 10 microns? Remember the CO2?
I think it's a radiative heater that at least
I'm not talking about the heating for the frequency, the wave. In other words, these are fairly broad lines probably associated with the structure. And so consequently you could shape the things up with 10 microns.
Oh, you mean add energy during deposition, not thermally but optically?
Right.
It's an interesting idea. Are you guys trying that too? You're doing everything else. Why didn't you do this?
Thanks, Jim, you got it.
Could make things easier to work.
It may not need to be a laser either, given the breadth of the energy distribution and coherent.
Well, it's just easy now. Yeah, a CO2 laser.
You know how to get CO2 lasers in the background.
Okay.
I think we need to move on here in the time. So next up is Ron. Thank you, Marty.
When did you download it?
This morning? Then you just changed it?
Yeah.
You did. This one.
So.
Yep. Well.
Good enough. Okay. So this is about this Voyager name. Just a name. There's no Voyage. It's meant to be the concept of what we can do in the existing facilities to get the maximum sensitivity. In sort of a reasonable way without going to very futuristic technology. So this is a diagram of what it would look like, very sort of cartoon diagram. And I would say this is sort of in between the idea of an incremental upgrade like the A+ and a more dramatic thing where you really remove all of the insides and put a new interferometer inside. This is something like replacing 20% or 25% of the optics, or rather all of the optics, but it's something like 20 to 25% of the stuff in terms of cost. It's mainly focused on replacing the test masses with large silicon mirrors But keeping the existing seismic isolation system and vacuum system. But the main consequence of changing the mirrors, of course, is changing the coatings, as you heard, but also changing the laser wavelength. And that the ripple effect of that is you have to change all of the optics in the system and recoat. So they can remain silica, but they'll all have to be replaced. And so that's probably the major work. This is an estimated sensitivity curve for what we get. This light blue one is not exactly where we are now. Where we are now is something like here, where the mouse is. But assuming that we solve all the problems and operate at full power, without squeezing, we would get to this light blue level, and then heard about the A plus. You know, as we calculate the sensitivity curves for these upgrades, of course, there's a lot of optimism involved, and it's mainly, I would say the main optimism is in assuming that there's no technical noise sources that limit us, even though, as I just said, technical noise sources always limit us. But, you know, it's the only way to make a apples-to-apples comparison. And so roughly the big improvement in the minimum comes from the use of a lot of squeezing and hoping that the thermal noise is actually improved by using this amorphous silicon material. Something like a squirt of two comes from having the lower temperature. That's mainly all. So what does it entail in systems? So the biggest piece, I would say, is this very large silicon mirror. I was sort of pessimistic about getting something like that, but after some discussions with industry, that looks like now possible. It's just at the limit of what could be done and the purity that we want. I'll talk a little bit about the laser wavelength choice later on. This is cryogenics, but according to the definition from the NIST, this is on the border of what you would call cryogenics. If it was a little bit warmer, this would just be called refrigeration or air conditioning. And if it's real cryogenics is below 50 Kelvin or something. So this is just cold, I should say. A lot of the, I think, reticence people have about making this kind of upgrade, of course, is that the whole system has to go down for a long time. And then the word cryogenics just makes people feel funny inside. I would say that's the major scientific objection. And cryogenics of this kind is not the kind that should really make you feel funny. I think this is something like a factor of two more complicated than having the cryopumps that we already have within the system. Anyway, there's some improvements and so on. The initial main motivation of going this route, it started in 2011. And at that point, I thought it's going to be extremely complicated. Extremely difficult for us to operate at a very high power. And so the whole purpose of this is that silicon operated in this refrigerated state has such a low coefficient of thermal expansion that we don't have to worry about the arm cavities getting the thermal bump on the surface and distorting the arm cavity mode. And so we can handle extremely high power. Since we're not so great at reducing the low frequency noise, but I would say medium successful at getting the optical gain and shot noise improvement at high frequencies, this seemed like a reasonable way to go to make our goal at 100 Hz. Since then, I think the coding problem has, you know, not sort of looked more and more challenging for room temperature. And of course, with our realization that this amorphous silicon and amorphous silica bilayer can be quite good, I would say a major motivation for this now is that we can operate with this coating, which looks like the, you know, sort of in the space of coatings, it looks like the only one which has no major showstoppers in making a big low mechanical loss system. Of course, it has the high absorption problem, but that's improved by orders of magnitude in the last few years. So I'm no longer so worried about that. This is a decision tree cartoon. This is even more complicated polyhedron than what you just saw. I'm just showing it here, but I'll end on this slide so you can we can discuss it. But I just want to describe some of these other points. So one of the, I think, serious problems with the Voyager idea would have been acquisition of these large pieces of silicon. We have this vendor who we're now working with who makes 45-centimeter diameter pieces, very long, using this alternative to the Czochralski method. We've now measured the absorption of some of these pieces, and it looks like in the 1.5 to 2 micron regime, we'll get down to below the goal of 10 ppm per centimeter. In fact, we may beat it by a factor of several. Coatings, so to make a high reflecting coating, you need a big index contrast. And with the gallium arsenide way, you only get a coating, you only get an index contrast of around 10%. And as a result, even though the hue is very good, you need around 80 layers in order to make the 5 ppm transmission that you want to make. Whereas for amorphous silicon, you have an index of around 3.5. So the index contrast is very big, and you can get away with just around 15 layers or so. And you can see, so the thermal noise of this one for a single optic is around 10 to the minus 21 meters at 100 hertz for an ETM, whereas the advanced LIGO one now is sort of 5 to 6 times higher. So the absorption problem has to be solved. I think now, based on the purity of the bulk pieces that we've measured, all of the absorption can be attributed to the coating, which means we need to make one more order of magnitude improvement in the absorption of amorphous silicon to go from 10 ppm down to 1 ppm. At that point, the whole heat extraction cryogenics business will be easy. So this is not my experiment, but it's one I've seen. This is, when I look at this, I think this is serious cryogenics. So this is something about this size operating at tens of millikelvin. And the experiment goes on at hundreds of kilohertz, and so they're not so worried about seismic noise, but because of the number of connections required in order to keep their system cool, even though they're pumping a lot of optical sort of optical slash electronic power into it, they have a lot of problems with heating and heat extraction. Some of you here may have been around long enough to remember these experiments, Mini Grail and Auriga. So there's been a set of, although not quite millikelvin bars, very low temperature bars, which were striving to be very sensitive to gravitational waves and very insensitive to the environment, so up conversion and seismic filtering. So this, there's some experience in our community with this. I would say that the cooling that we require for Voyager is much, much less ambitious than these ideas. Although these are mainly aimed at kilohertz frequencies, and we're trying to get low temperature at the 10 hertz sensitivity, it's not so hard. The idea, of course, is to do it mainly with non-contact. And so we have a few different vendors here. There's Aktar in Israel, Surrey Nanosystems in the UK, and NASA Goddard makes this carbon nanotube film. And so we would coat the barrel of the optic, not the optical faces, but the side with this black nanotube stuff. And I estimate we can radiate about 8 to 10 watts this way. And our collaborators in Moscow State have measured the hue of this stuff. And if we coat our large mirrors with it, it won't impact the thermal noise in the system. This is a drawing of what things would look like. So here I've removed the suspension so you can see the optic to scale within the existing system. This is the full 200 kilogram, sorry, maybe this is a 150 kilogram system. In order to allow cooling, we would have a shroud which goes around this sort of a box. And then we would put this tube here, very similar to what the Cogra folks have done. And this tube would be connected partially to this existing liquid nitrogen bath and probably a couple of other connections around here to provide conductive cooling to this thing. This would be black on the inside, and the blackness of this thing sort of baffles the hot radiation from the main beam from impacting the test mass. And so the chief worries here are, of course, can the heat deposition and the optic be kept low enough, and can these cryogenic systems be made quiet enough so that they don't matter? Brett Shapiro has done some modeling of this scattering noise based on the work partially of the Cagra team, and it looks fine. The laser is somewhat of a worry, but I would say less of a worry than it is for 1.5 microns. We looked at the development timeline for advanced LIGO and looked at it as an exercise to say, imagine that we started actually doing this now, when would the laser be ready? Because we don't actually have to rebuild all of the enclosures and cooling for the new system. It's a little bit compressed from the advanced LIGO schedule, but it's basically based on what the AEI did. And we would be sort of ready in the 2023 to 2026 timeframe with just the laser. Luckily, there's a lot of work going on internationally on 2-micron CW lasers. We don't actually have a demonstration of one that would work right now, but there's, again, no big technical roadblocks. The wavelength choice is sort of has a lot of considerations which go into it. I won't go into it now, but we can talk about it. The main point is that at there's questions of the quantum efficiency of detectors, the availability of lasers, and the optical absorption. At 1.5 microns, the absorption and the coating will be bigger than that at 2 microns. And so in terms of absorption, we're pushed to longer wavelength, but quantitatively, there's no big difference between 2 and 2.1 or something like that. So really, the final decider of the wavelength will be laser technology in the 1.9 to 2.1 micron regime. This is just sort of an algebra aid for how how the sensitivity of interferometers works versus wavelength. I myself used to get confused about this before. So what have we held constant here? There's 3 megawatts in the arm cavity, and the red curve is what you get. Sort of the purple curve is what you get with 1064 nanometers, what we have now. And with the same arm cavity power, the shot noise limited sensitivity is worse with 2 microns, and the radiation pressure noise is better. But maybe a more convenient way to think about it is if we had 1 megawatt in the arm at 1064, we would need 2 megawatts at double the wavelength in order to have basically the same sensitivity. So 3 megawatts at 2 microns is sort of equivalent to having our 1.5 megawatts with the 1064. So in my mind, I would say, although we haven't proven that we can have 1.5 megawatts at 1 micron, if the advanced LIGO is successful in getting to 800 kilowatts in the arm cavity, I don't see realistically that there would be a big trouble in getting the next factor of 2. So I'm much more optimistic about high power at 1 micron than I used to be. And so I think this as a motivating factor, you know, that we get super high powers at long wavelength is not so strong anymore. Prototype, I would say, if you have questions about prototyping, we can talk about it during lunch. You should certainly prototype. Let me just spend a minute or two on this final slide. So how to decide about what we should do? Well, if it turns out that this superstable glass approach works or something else comes up and we're able to get, you know, a factor of 2 or more at room temperature using 1 micron, then the motivation to really make a big technology change becomes less and less. On the other hand, if it turns out it's 2 or 3 years from now and we still haven't made any significant improvement at room temperature, we only have a root 2 or something, we had better be ready with something like this in the near term and not wait until 2030 to implement this, because we don't want to be plateaued at the same sensitivity for a decade. We should really be ready in the near term. But, you know, thinking optimistically, we'll have wonderful improvements at room temperature coatings in 3 or 4 years. If we really, you know, find a technology that's, that doesn't bottom out with a root 2, if it really goes a bit, and then it looks like with further work, it'll get another factor of 2 and 3 and 4 and 5, then that basically undercuts the whole motivation for this boyfriend technology. So I think that's the right way to decide about whether to do it or not. The point of this cartoon, if you follow it through, if we take this as a starting point, we want to look at each of these technologies and whether they sort of work or not, depending upon how we define it. And that tells us about whether or not it's Voyager is the thing that we should do. And why is Explorer in here? We'd like this to be a technology that we can also use at the larger scale. And so if it turns out for some reason that this technology also only works with little mirrors, it's not a thing that's going to scale to a 10-kilometer or 40-kilometer system. And then we should, again, take that into account when considering whether to do it or not. So I don't want to walk through all these points so that anybody can, based on the good, bad flag, even figure out how it works. Yes, so I've given Marty 5 minutes of my time, so that's it for me. Thank you.
Yeah, so I think you put it the right way. When we're talking about something of this magnitude, we really need to be working on it, you know, with the idea that there's decisions down the road that we can't predict, but the idea of being ready for it the way they might break. And so I'm just looking at the purple stripe here, the 2-micron optics and so on, and going back to your previous slide about doing a prototype that's running at a different wavelength, right? That's basically built into our DNA, 1 micron, for so long now that it seems like that's like the most important thing, at least taking aside all the material science stuff that we don't understand. That's the most important thing that in the lab we should be doing is tooling up for 2 microns. So can you go back to your prototype and say a little bit when you think that could start happening?
Yep. So there's this project in the EU FP7 funded project called ILA? I don't know if that's a coincidence, but the idea of it was to fund research into all parts of 2-micron technology, AOMs, EOMs, and so on. And if you look at the papers that came out of it, it's not quite all done, but a lot of good work was done in this area, and it's because 2-micron lasers have a lot of application outside of basic science. So it somewhat exists, but I think that study mainly highlighted how hard it is going to be to get all those things working. And like we know from our 1-micron experience, even after, I can't count the year, it's beyond my past event horizon, but whenever people started working on YAG lasers until 2007, we were still having problems getting the modulators working for the eLIGO. So for this, we want to find out what are the real problems which don't show up on an analytic sensitivity curve. When we try to put together a system like this, we will have to have somewhat low noise cryogenic shielding and pump down capability. Of course, this is a sketch of the 40 meter lab, but you know, anyone who wants to do this anyone who wants to do this more than me is welcome to do it. And then I'll do something else. But it would be a refit of all of these things. All of our detectors, we'd have to push the 2-micron detector technology to get high quantum efficiency systems and make quad detectors of 2 microns. Of course, we would have to really study how to do coatings at 2 microns, which sort of exist, but even in the amorphous case, don't exist for room temperature with low absorption today. And I think there's no real challenge in the metrology. But we wouldn't be satisfied, I think, with the performance that we've seen in the past from the 40-meter lab, which is really only sensitive above 300 hertz. And we have to do some sort of retrofit here in order to get sort of a factor of 5 or 6 lower seismic wall. And Caltech has agreed to pony up some money in terms of infrastructure for pushing this idea. So they're at least, you know, the money is not in the pocket yet, so, but conceptually they're behind it.
Okay.
Yeah, so you got cryogenic monolithic suspensions up there, and, but you never really said anything about suspension.
Right.
So the cell kind of changes.
Yeah, but our concept is at the moment to basically reuse the upper stages and then retrofit the bottom half into something that's cryogenic compatible. And then there's some decision points about whether or not it's just the final mass or the final two masses which have to be cryogenic. And then there's details about what exactly the suspension fiber or ribbon would be. And those are all still open questions, and mostly with the work being done in Glasgow on what can be done. And of course, attaching ribbons and supporting a 200 kilogram piece is a pretty challenging thing.
Ronnie, you pointed out the point of this refrigerated temperature to the tractor box because C temperature is zero in the cylinder. Are you assuming that we don't need to use heat to control the temperature of our beers in the now?
Yeah, that's right. So the idea is that it's a technical point, I guess, because the DNDT of silicon is much higher than silica. The heat which is deposited in the test mass is very uniform, but effectively the thermal lens in the ITM will be as large as it is now. And so we still need to have the compensation plates. But that's an actuation which goes on the outside of the arm cavity, not inside. So we would eliminate the ring heaters which are used to heat the masses, but we would still need the thermal wavefront correction. And I think I would just call it part of the adaptive optics system.
Go ahead.
Ron, we can discuss this privately, I'm sure. If you left out the 2 micron thing because it's a solution to the coating problem, there must be other things in this that bring you down to the level where you're sort of at the facility limit. And I'd be curious if you can sort of say, maybe you don't have it, but what contributions you get to better noise comes from other things in the conversion of 2 micron. Larger masses, you're also trying to use higher power. Those are the two other constraints, aside from the fact that you allegedly have solved the coding problem. That's maybe very useful. If the coding problem does get solved by, let's say, the 1 micron system, still probably want to go the next step in the 4 micron system.
Well, there are those reasons, but they're not so compelling. And the reason is, I don't think, for example, it would be so terrible to get us 150 kilogram fused silica mass.
Right.
So this is a big mass, but we could have a big mass at 1 micron at room temperature. And this is 3 megawatts at room temperature. What if we can get 1.5 megawatts with 1 micron at room temperature? It's not ruled out. It's not ruled in. But if we run into trouble with high power in the advanced LIGO, this may be a way to go. On the other hand, the optics have come out with such a low absorption that I feel better about going to high power. If that turns out, you know, each of those things, if they happen, then it takes the teeth out of this kind of upgrade. But there's no, there's other things that could have happened, like the change in the residual gas noise or a big change in the scattering.
Just look at the edge against the ability to make like a better coating. I think you got a thing here which could make the next improvement without.
That's what I was going to say. Which is, if just to say again, if you look at the case of the S5 and the S6 runs, it's not true that we ever improved the noise there at the low frequencies. We got stuck in 2006, and in 2010 we had the same noise from 60 hertz to 90 hertz, and although we talked about it and everyone had ideas, in the end, the reason that the improvement happened is because we threw away all that stuff and put in a new interferometer, and things were better. And that's the story of how that noise was fixed. And it may be that that kind of thing is what we need again, just reboot all the hardware, and let's hope that the noise gets better.
I also want to address Ray's question a little bit obliquely. I think we were always talking about what's the killer that's going to get us a factor of 2, factor of 5, factor of 10, things like that. From this point of view, that's a good thing. I think at the point where we're actually observing, and especially at the point where we have alternative observatories that are able to pick up the slack, the threshold for doing an upgrade is going to be quite small. 1.25 cubed would be worth doing, okay, at a certain future point. So I think we have to think about it not in terms of the economics of today or yesterday, pre-discovery, for example. We have to think about it in terms of the economics of what we're actually planning with the science. And the sunk investment in the facilities up to that point, you know, $1 billion or so, if you can make it a factor of 2 greater event rate, it's very difficult not to go ahead and do that. Right? And so if we have to think about in the future, those decisions will be based on a different set of criteria than what we're used to.
I think that's right, but I think there's also nuances too, in the sense that the factor of 2 greater event rates talks about a certain kind of event. So if we look at the phase space, we haven't seen binary neutrons.
Exactly. So it's going to change the economics of it. So I agree with Ray that you don't say that this decision point makes this set of ideas obsolete.
Yeah.
It makes it less favorable in some set of assumptions, but possibly still.
Okay. Last question from Brian, and then we'll break for lunch.
I just have a quick comment. I'm not on this, but I think some other people in the room may not. I mean, there's already, in addition to the work that Rana showed, quite a bit of research going on in carbon. Stanford, and Alaska. So there are a bunch of people in the community who are working on getting new experiments. It's not that we can try to make sure that there's a cryogenic shield is actually that. It's not there yet.
So two things. First, we're going to break for lunch, and I talked to Laura. If we come back at 1:15, that gives us an hour. That should be back over time.
Yeah,
and
we get
to
here.
Oh, you
can.
You
can
wander
outside.
Okay. All right. So let's plan on being back here at 1:15. The other thing I want to do is just introduce somebody. So most of the people in this room might even know LIGO. But we do have somebody who's visiting, who's not a formal member of the collaborator of LIGO or Virgo, but is here to explore the phase space for trying to maybe do something in time to shoot them out. So you know, introduce yourself. He's from Tsinghua University. He's going to be here for the entire workshop, and I'm sure he'd be interested in talking with you and getting a feel for how big the boys work, because he's trying to spearhead something in China.
So if I mentioned it as well,
probably one of the person who knows the least about LIGO, but I'm trying to very clear things. So Tsinghua is of the top 2 universities in China. It's quite interesting in developing gravitational wave astronomy, but it's still at the initial stage. So I'm here to talk. Okay.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much.